Thank you, sir.
Come, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Too loud? Not loud enough?
Perfect.
Well, as usual, Bob knows how to draw a crowd, doesn't he? thank you all very much for coming. This is our last History Speaker Series program for the year, and Bob always says it'll be his last program. I've been hearing that for a lot of years now, but just in case, I'm glad you all came to hear it. I don't think you're going to be disappointed. We'd like to first thank the Boyne District Library. They've been supportive and collaborating with us for the last 13 years now that CHIPS has been in existence. And pretty exciting for them coming up in 2018 is their centennial. And on February 3rd, they're going to be having a history of the library, so mark your calendars for that. Also, thank you to all of our veterans. This is always a special time for me because we have our Wreaths Across America program in Bay Township. It'll be our fourth year. But Veterans Day, Memorial Day, all those special days, we can't say thank you enough. Want to thank Michelle Hewitt and the New Museum Group for letting us borrow the very special ring and watch. It's right there on the table. Obviously, don't touch. You'll also notice around the room some little vignettes of newspaper articles and things. These are just some of the things out of Bob's archives. Back in the days of in the 70s when we didn't have all the high tech we have today, we were writing letters to gather information, sometimes waiting months and months to get a response, and sometimes that was disappointing. To get a copy of a document was always a little bit of a challenge, and we had to pay, write a check, wait and wait. It still is that way today for some things, but obviously internet has made things, research a lot easier in some ways, but we still have to use all the other modes that we've used in the past. So you'll also get a kick probably out of looking at some of the newspaper articles. Bob has been a teacher, I think, all of his life. And what he did for Boyne City history in particular is one of the most outstanding things that I've come across in my experience. So we're really honoring Bob too today because he's an outstanding teacher, and his legacy is gonna live on and on and on because he not only gives the programs, but we get CDs of them, we get the PowerPoint presentations, we get a lot of the original work that he's accumulated. So we have a lot of that here today too. And the book is here, the Clock Tower book. It's CHIPS' first hardback book. We did another print-on-demand book, The Park Avenue Prowl, about 4 years ago. So I want to especially thank Keisha Freed and Patrick for all their work on designing. That was quite a challenge, but we did it. And they'll be available today for sale and also for Bob to sign. They're also available at three locations in Boyne City. Ralph Gillette's office has them for sale. Linda Christensen has them at her real estate office. And they're here at the Boyne District Library for sale, too. So let us know when you want more. Patrick is going to talk a little bit about some of the other things we have for sale. And I want to thank Diane and Steve. All summer long at Stroll the Streets, they have been helping us sell all of the postcards and books and things. So, and they're here today. They're still having fun taking your money. So thanks, guys. Patrick?
I probably just talked loud enough. I didn't know that I was going to be telling you about this until about 5 minutes ago, so bear with me a minute. CHIPS has always been about preserving and archiving things. While we had the opportunity to scan a collection and preserve a collection and then return it to the owner. Once those collections are obtained, though, unless they're used and work together with other things, they don't do us any good. They don't do us any good, and they don't do you any good. And so putting together the books, putting together postcard series, we find that things tend to work better in sort of a series thing, almost like a collectible thing, because people like that better. The clock tower book, the timing was perfect with the new clock tower being restored downtown. That is the first in the series. The next one is the red book over there. You can see that says firefighting. That one was kind of my baby. I opted to put that on hold so that we didn't have any conflicts of interest with what was going on, you know, with the city events and things like that. So fortunately, we were able to work with Keisha Freed Design in coming up with those. The firefighting book is the second in the series. That one will take it up to 19. I was just talking to someone over here about it's either 51 or 52, which was when the old fire truck stopped being used. At that point, and like it says at the last page of the book, I turn that over to somebody who knows a lot more about firefighting and trucks and all of that. That was not my interest. It was only to document the early fires and the early firemen. We've had a lot of people say, well, you know, why is no one else involved in doing the research? Because when you're researching pre-1920 records, it's pretty much going page by page through the newspaper. And so if I have any volunteers to do that, but I don't see any hands. So that was why my focus was that period of time. Firefighting will be number two. I would like very much for number three to be a residential series, but that can't happen unless all of you folks and other folks help us support the first two projects. The postcard series, which is at the back, having original photographs of things it's sometimes very hard to do. It's very hard to find. For example, the picture of the fire engine that's framed over there, that was a limited series edition because everyone that I talked to, I have an original of that picture. Which I paid $150 in order to get an original of. Everyone kept saying, well, you know, how can we get a copy of that? And so what we did was a specialty stamp for it, a custom stamp, and then we were very fortunate again to have Georgiana Monk from Friar Tuck's, who is a professional framer. So I think that we're down to having just six left. It was a limited edition of 20. And I think we're down to having six left. So if that's something that you're interested in for yourself or for a gift, now's the time. The postcard series, the first set, and we made those really nominally priced. They were $5 a set. So hopefully it would encourage people to start out with sets one and two, because next year sets three and four are another whole cool thing of, you know, pictures. The first set happened to come from my own collection. The second set is made up of photographs that the library had here in this big scrapbook thing and some other sources that they have that aren't readily available to the public. So those pictures are, you know, they're unusual pictures. They're not ones that you run across every day and would cost a lot more than $5 to come up with to have for your own collection. So hopefully you'll take a look at those. There's some back that there's also some cards and things in the clock, but I guess that's about it as far as what did I forget? Oh, Bob's original book, Settlers to Sidewalks, he recently had that reprinted. And it's, how many reprintings has it been, Bob?
Four.
So this is the fourth one, and he still has trouble keeping them in stock. The places that sell them for him and our own membership, we continuously, I was president of the genealogical group for a lot of years, and that was our number one request from people writing into the group, wanting copies of. So that's also available. And I think you've probably heard enough of me, you're probably ready to hear from Bob. So.
Okay, so just a couple, the bathrooms, if anybody needs them, are right outside the community room door. And if you would, so we can keep the presentation moving, if you'd hold all your questions until the end, we'd really appreciate it. So without further ado, join me in welcoming Bob Morkridge.
Well, great. This is a wonderful group of people. You never know what's going to happen. I'm really proud to bring you this program tonight because this is the first one I did as a teacher at Boyne City High School. I really want to thank the Boyne City Public School System for allowing me to develop a one-semester local history course. It doesn't happen very often. And they allowed me to have the students take pictures from their grandparents, seek out information, research information from the newspapers, and put together slide programs and activities to do in a classroom. So I really appreciate the Boyne City Public High School, but I appreciate the students. This began in 1971, and the students presented these slide programs all the way from 1971 to 1999 when I retired. I had nothing to do with it. You know, I was the coach. They did the programs. And we did a lot of programs too, but seeing that I'm no longer a teacher, you're stuck with me. We originally organized a Pine Lake History Club. We thought it was a nice way to do it, to start off with. And so that's why you see Pine Lake History Club on the slide program. I taught the history of Boyne City for 27 years, and I really enjoyed it. And we're so proud in Boyne City to have such great students that could do things and take over and put on programs for the community. Well, let's begin. It was late in the day on November 14th, 1856, when this man, his wife, and friend beached their sailboats on the shores of Boyne. After walking up the hill, they found a dilapidated shelter, their dream cabin, which they immediately claimed as their home. And thus began a residency that marks the beginning of the history of Boyne. These hardy pioneers were John and Harriet Miller, and why they came to Boyne is one of the most remarkable stories in the history of our county. John Miller was born on October 10, 1811, in the land of small farms, pastures, and great peat bogs. He was the son of Hugh and Agnes Miller. I found this sketch of John Miller in the public library done by Rosa Nettleton, and I'm so happy to have found something of a picture of what he looked like when he was younger. John's birthplace was in Ireland. Okay. In St. Andrew's Townland, in the county of Down, I think you can see the arrow leading up to it. It's a very scenic area. I'm really impressed with the area. But a few years prior to the tragic Irish potato famine, he and his parents left Ireland. After a stormy voyage of 7 weeks and 3 days, they landed in Quebec on April 17, 1823. They eventually proceeded up the St. Lawrence River and settled near Ogdensburg in Upper State New York. On Christmas Day in 1840, John Miller married a 16-year-old Canadian girl by the name of Harriet Russell, and two children were born in the Miller family, Hugh in 1842 and James the following year. In 1843, the Millers bought a large farm in Oswegatchie Township in St. Lawrence County in upstate New York. And I happened to go to Oswegatchie a couple of years ago. I was extremely disappointed because their birth records and marriage records, they don't have them, okay? Death records, there's nothing until about the 1870s. You want to back up a slide? I lost my place. Go ahead, please. On Christmas Day in 1840, I read that one to you. Okay, let's go to the next one. Sorry about that.
Go to number 12, Bob.
In 1843, the Millers, okay. Okay, I got it. Thanks a lot. Excuse me. Wow, you're not reading it. You're not nervous. For 12 years, the Millers cultivated their land, hoed their garden, and apparently led a contented life. Then one morning in 1855, it is said that Harriet awoke from a dream. In her dream, she envisioned a lake to the west that was shaped like a bear and had an abandoned cabin at its eastern end. Convinced that she must seek out this mysterious place, Harriet persuaded her devoted husband to sell their farm, pack their bags, and head westward. It took them a while to settle their affairs. Finally, they made their way to Ogdensburg, New York, where they booked passage on a steamer routed to Chicago. The steamer was owned by the Northern Transportation Line and made its scheduled stop at Northport to take on propeller wood for fuel. Northport had its beginning with the Reverend George Smith relocated a band of Ottawa Indians from Holland, Michigan, in the vicinity in 1849. Go ahead, please.
18.
2 years later, the father of Northport, Deacon Joseph Dame, arrived shortly and planted the village of Northport. Dame diligently began constructing a dock. In 1955, Dame sold the partially completed dock to H.O. Rose. Now, some of you, when you go to Petoskey, can see a sign on some of the walls, the buildings, that say H.O. Rose. Go ahead. And Amos Fox. Amos Fox was more important than Charlevoix. Fox and Rose finished constructing the dock in 1856. That's important. In 1856, and contracted to sell propeller cordwood to the Northern Transportation Line Company steamships that traveled from Ogdensburg to Chicago. I think this is an amazing picture. In 1856, Fox and Rose contracted with the Northern Transportation Line Company was a very crucial part of our history. For it was on these docks that the Millers stood in October of 1856, waiting for their steamer to be loaded with cordwood, that a decisive event occurred that would determine the course of their lives. Whether by accident or design, the Millers struck up a conversation with a gentleman by the name of John Sargent Dixon. According to a book entitled The Traverse Region, published in 1884, Harriet told the writer that when she first caught sight of Mr. Dixon on the wharf, she recognized him at once as the person she had seen in her dream. And right down below is a copy out of the book, The Traverse Region, that Harriet Miller told the writer of The Traverse Region. In their conversation, we do not know if Harriet Miller asked John Dixon if the lake was shaped like a bear. But I would like to say that all parts of Harriet Miller's dream are documented in the Traverse Region, except for the part about visualizing a bear-shaped lake. This part of the dream has been handed down through the family and strongly defended as true. Vera Tulpley, great-granddaughter of Harriet Miller, adamantly told me this part of the dream occurred. Well, was Lake Charlotte shaped like a bear? Now, my students, for 27 years, had many thoughts about this. But I'm an old-timer, and I believe that's the head of the bear there. That's the ears. That's the back, and that's the rump. And those are the back legs. And this, the only thing that's really out of joint are the front legs. But there's the mouth. Now, you can believe it if you want to. It's up to you. It's entirely up to your imagination. But one time, and I've been teaching this for maybe 10 years, a student, and I can't remember who it was, raised their hand. And they said, Mr. Morridge, there's another bear in that picture. And I said, where? And they said they walked up to it. They didn't have this pointer. And they said, here it is right here. Here's his back, his forehead, his mouth, chin, his breast. And she, that boy, I think it was a boy. And he said, that looks more like a bear than the lake does. Well, you can solve that problem. So upon the dock, it was supported by these pilings. An agreement was reached. The Millers would accompany Dixon to the shores of this lake. This photograph was taken about 1970. When I first got interested in Boyne City, I went to Northport to investigate the Northern Transportation Line. I was lucky, I went into a grocery store, and it was owned by a Mr. Dame. Now, if you remember, the father of Northport is Mr. Dame. This was his great-great-grandfather or what. And he took me around Northport, and he took me down to these spilings. And he said, these are the spilings upon which the dock was built, where the Northern Transportation Line Company docked to take on propeller wood, and this had to be the place where the Millers got off. And I just feel fortunate to have had a picture of these spilings. Go ahead, please. On October 26, 1856, the boat transporting Dixon and the Millers slid to a halt in front of a village of fishermen shacks that lined Lake Michigan shore. This is a drawing that came from the Bob Miles book. Actually, the dock was built in 1856, but I wanted to give you some kind of a look of the front of Lake Charlevoix as you approached it, and there's Pine River off to the right. At this village called Pine River, now called Charlevoix, they stayed for several weeks. It is possible that John Miller helped Dixon build the first house in Charlevoix. John Dixon undoubtedly pleaded with the Millers to make Pine River their home, but Harriet was reluctant and insisted on exploring the eastern end of the lake. Consequently, the Millers and Dixon set out on a sailboat, and later on Friday, November 14th, 1856, their boat struck the shores of North Point, where the landings are located today. F- 46 years ago, it's coming Tuesday, in 1971, a group of local students, history students, along with Anna Dietz, the late Anna Dietz, dedicated a historical marker celebrating the 115th anniversary of the Miller Landings. Are there any students in the room that participated in this event? I was hoping we might get one or two. Well, we had a great time. Go ahead, please. After beaching the stairwell, they climbed a hill spotted with green evergreens trees until they reached the clearing and discovered an abandoned dream cabin. Now, this is not the cabin that they saw. This cabin was built in 1862 by John Miller. We have no picture of the cabin. The shelter, the cabin that Harriet Miller had in her dream, had originally been built by Reuben T. Nichols, who was a strange-eyed Mormon. And when news reached Reuben Nichols that his king, King James J. Strang, on Beaver Island had been assassinated on June 16, 1856, and that all the Mormons had been driven off Beaver Island, he and other Mormons living along Lyon Street decided to flee the area. Nichols put his goods on a scow, tied his cow behind, and pulled his way along the shoreline to Charlevoix and out of the area. It's said that there were a number of Mormon cabins on Lyon Street. I think most of you might know where Lyon Street is. You'll get a better idea in a minute. Nichols eventually came back to the Torch Lake area and homesteaded. And if you go south of Eastport, you'll come to Nichols Road. And if you go down the road about a half a mile on the left-hand side, he had a homestead in the 1870s and 80s. I found his burial spot on the Bayview Cemetery, not far from Eastwood, Eastport, Michigan. The cabin in this photo was built by John Miller in 1862. Again, there are no photographs of the original cabin. The original cabin was a dirt floor. And if you read down at the bottom here, you might get an idea of what it's like. Mrs. Miller related a curious dream she had before leaving Oswegatchie, the fulfillment of which she recognized in the circumstances of their arrival at the new home. She saw in her new home the log home, as it actually was, with a roof made of trowels, as the settlers sometimes made them when boards were scarce, with trowels inverted on the ridge in place of weather boards. Inside the weather-beaten cabin, or shack, we might say, the Millers built a floor fire and prepared to read after the They built a fire and prepared to rest after their tiring day's journey. To Harriet Miller, it was unbelievable. Almost everything appeared as she had seen in her dream, and it made a deep and lasting impression. Take a look at some of the artifacts that you will see on top of the Miller home. My gosh. You can see a ladder back here. You can see a milk can, Crocs, a press, maybe an apple press. Just all kinds of artifacts. Must be they wanted to keep the roof down in case of a rain. The board shanty was located where this home now stands, at the corner of Groveland and Michigan Avenue in North Boyne. It was near this home that the Millers found the potatoes that Nichols had planted, and they dug them out of the snow to supplement their meager provisions. Thus, the Millers became the first permanent settlers in Boyne. Shortly after they were settled in their dream cabin, John and his two sons, Hugh and James, explored the shoreline of Long Pine Lake. Soon they came upon a scenic stream that reminded John of one he knew in Ireland. Well, that's a pretty picture of the Boyne River in Ireland. He promptly christened it the Boyne River. I'd like to note at this time that certain very crucial events occurred that led to a, that were very significant and had a significant bearing on the settlement and the naming of Boyne. Just think, had the Millers traveled to this area before 1856, they would never have stopped at Northport because there would have been no dock. Had King Strang been living, I don't know how many of you people know about history of King Strang, but he'd been assassinated in June of 1856 on Beaver Island, and all the armor, all the people, the Mormons, were forced to flee the area. Had King Strang been living when he arrived at, when they arrived at Northport, Reuben T. Nichols would still have been living in the cabin. And if Ernest Miller had occurred later than what it did, you might have found somebody else living in the Mormon cabin. Therefore, one might conclude, whether by accident or design, the timing of Harriet Miller's dream was decisive in the history and the naming of Boyne City. During the first 6 weeks, the Millers did not see another person. From them, two Indians, they learned about Andrew Porter, the head of an Indian mission at Bear Creek, now Petoskey. Here John Miller set out, making his way through the snow on snowshoes. He later returned to work for Porter for 75 cents a day. John and his son James had a sailboat called the Union Jack. In the years before Lake Charlevoix was open to steam traffic, they made daily trips in the summer from the head of Pine Lake to Charlevoix carrying freight and passengers. In July of 1873, Edward Couch and a friend booked passage in Charlevoix on the Miller's Union Jack returning to Boyne. Mr. Couch said, "We started out early in the morning, and to me it was a very pleasant trip, for it was the first time I had ridden in a sailboat. We got about halfway up the lake when the wind went down and the boat moved very slowly. So I proposed to George that we take a swim. He agreed, and we soon had our clothes off and were in the water swimming alongside the boat, and it was fun. In about an hour, the wind rose and we got to the Millers about supper time." He died in 1917, Mr. Couch did. One time when Hugh was working in Bear Creek, John and his son James sailed the Union Jack to Pine River to obtain supplies. The stress of weather compelled them to remain longer than what was anticipated. For 14 days, Harriet remained alone, tending the cows and hoeing the garden. In June of the same year, she had gone out in the morning after the cows and got lost in the woods. For 2 days, she drank milk and slept next to the cows until she was found by a search party of Indians from Bear Creek. In 1869, John Miller became the first postmaster in Boyne. The office was in its living room. The postmaster got to see the neighboring settlers, and everyone called him Uncle John. That's the back side of the cabin. The mail was brought from Traverse City by Indian carriers who usually traveled on foot. Mitchell LaCroix was one of the first Indian carriers, and some of his descendants still reside in the Boyne area. In this 1873 check, you can see John Miller paying Mitchell LaCroix for services rendered. As the years rolled by, Uncle John busied himself by clearing his farm, which is now the site of the Lakeview Village Mobile Home Park. Around 1876, he planted a village called Spring Harbor, and the village was basically located between Vogel and Groveland Streets. In the photo, he is seen resting on his farm along the right-of-way of the Spring Harbor and Boyne Falls Railroad, which operated only from 1882 to 1885. He is probably sitting where the landings are located today. In the background is the tourist home built by H. B. Chapman in 1883. Chapman platted his own village that he called Spring Harbor. Chapman must have liked John Miller enough to name a street after him. Frontier life had its joys and sorrows. Tragedy struck the Miller family when, on the night of December 26, 1869, their youngest son, James, fell through the ice near the mouth of the Boyne River. On a Sunday evening, he was skating home from his fiancée's home in Advance. James was to be married the next day to a young lady whose last name was Bartlett. Realizing he was losing the desperate struggle to pull himself out of the water, he may have placed his watch and ring on the edge of the ice before yielding to the tug of the current in the frigid waters of Pine Lake. As the light of day faded, the gloom of darkness descended upon the Miller home. Worried parents ventured out in search of their son. Undoubtedly, tears were shed on the edge of the ice as they recovered the watch and ring, cognizant of what had been fallen his son. James left not only to his parents, but for posterity, this watch and ring. The great-granddaughter of John Miller, the late Vera Tokley, was a possessor of these artifacts. She donated the watch and ring and many other facts and many other Miller artifacts to the Boyne City Museum shortly before she passed away. And Michelle, would you show them? Would you go back one slide, please? Would you show them the watch and ring here?
Yeah, well, there's on the table here up in front, so it's kind of hard to pick it up and move it around, but as you meander around after the presentation, come up and take a look at it.
Well, thanks a lot for bringing them. Go back, please. Okay, go ahead, please. The other son, Hugh, lived in the Boyne until his death in 1923. For years, he was a mailman who drove a stagecoach between Boyne City and Charlevoix, picking up and delivering mail. He was the oldest postmaster. He was also the postmaster for North Boyne. The post office was in his grocery store located at the foot of Charlevoix Street. His wife, Phoebe Cady, was the daughter of one of the earliest settlers in the Evangeline Township. Their daughter, the late Agnes Lorch, was one of the first white children born in the Boyne area. The late Herb Snyder said he remembered her as being a beautiful red-headed woman. He said she went to Chicago and married Ed Lorch. She passed away in 1957. Ed and Agnes Lorch had a daughter, Vera Lorch Tokley. In September of 1980, thanks to the cooperation of Nancy Ferguson and the public library, the Boyne City Middle School students hosted a community program to honor Vera Lorch, the great-granddaughter of the Millers. It was presented the community with a side program and a large photograph of the Miller cabin located on the wall in this community room. It's located right over here to the right of the... And they also served refreshments. She is now at rest in Evangeline Cemetery. Hugh Miller spent his final days in a home he constructed in 1923. The home was located not too far from the intersection of Court and Lake Streets in North Point. It is said that he was a rather quiet person and not given to spinning yarns. In 1945, the house burned to the ground, but the chimney stood for many years until it was razed. The dress and bonnet that Harriet Miller wore in this photograph were lost in the fire. As Boyne headed towards its peak as a lumbering town, John passed away. He was deaf during the last few years of his life and suffered terribly until he died of inflammation of the kidneys and rheumatism on May 8, 1896. Harriet passed a few years later. Today, all the Millers rest in eternal place around four sides of this gravestone in Evangeline Cemetery. Over the 27 years that I taught local history, every Boyne City student visited the gravesite and the cemetery. And it is, and it was, because of these two people, a determined woman following a dream and a gentle but nostalgic man, that the community of Boyne was settled and named. Incredibly, Boyne City was left with as unique and interesting historical beginning as any community has ever recorded in the pages of history. And thank you very much. I'd just like to thank the people at the public library, Georgiana Monk, and all the other people involved in putting on this program. I did nothing but sit here and watch them do it. Maybe that was good. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks a lot.
Good job, Bob. You did a great job. You did.
I stumbled so much.
No, don't be so hard on yourself. That was awesome.
I have a question for you. I live on the corner of Lake and
he says that about every